The topic is legal substitution and experiential transformation in the typology of Leviticus. When well-meaning Christians interpret the effects of Christ's sacrifice, some emphasize legal substitution at the expense of experiential transformation. Others do the opposite, emphasizing experiential aspects to the detriment of legal function. These tendencies are especially evident in the polarization between adherents of forensic-only justification and moral influence theory. No wonder people are confused, especially when they can purchase books representing radically different or even mutually exclusive explanations of the way they're supposed to be saved in the same Christian bookstore. I think this is serious. I think the issue of soteriology should be really clear. Our people should know how they're saved. The present research demonstrates that in the soteriological typology of Leviticus, which serves as background to explication of Christ's sacrifice in the book of Hebrews, both legal substitution and experiential transformation are clearly present and fully necessary. First, we will examine evidence for legal substitution in Leviticus and identify some references to this dynamic in Hebrews. Second, we will explore experiential transformation in Leviticus and point out some references to this element in Hebrews. First, legal substitution. First section, background. Legal in this context does not in any way imply legalistic. Rather, it has to do with a person's relationship to God as it is affected by failure to follow principles that are in harmony with his character of love as expressed in his law. Such legal problems caused by illegal activities, which we call sins, are objective in the sense that when they are already done, they cannot be changed because they are historical events. The penalty for committing sin is death because sin breaks God's law, which is unselfish love. Love is the only principle on the basis of which intelligent beings with free choice can exist. So preservation of the society of the universe requires the non-existence of those who violate love. Paradoxically, however, the very same love of God that condemns sinners impels him to want to save us, for God so loved the world, that is, all lost inhabitants of planet Earth. On what basis can he extend mercy and at the same time preserve his justice, which is the other side of his love? Sinners are already condemned, so there is nothing that they can offer to God to justify their deliverance from eternal fate. Neither can the human race be spared by simply destroying the sinners among us, as Phinehas purged Israel by spearing Zimri and his Midianite girlfriend when they were commencing a blatant act of fornication. This decisive, drastic move by Phinehas accomplished key pair, the peel of kapar, the verb usually translated to make atonement. His key pair purged Israel in order to deliver the community from continuation of divine plague. It was kippur in the basic sense of removing a problem between two parties, in this case between Israel and God, in order to allow for the possibility of reconciliation, which is what the English word atonement or at-one-ment means. If God ultimately applied the approach of Phinehas to the whole human race in terms of its eternal existence or non-existence, it simply would have become extinct long ago because all have sinned. All would be speared, none would be spared. I had to throw that in there. Sorry about that. God needs a kippur solution. Hope you got the point. God needs a kippur solution that removes our objective culpability for sin, which obstructs our relationship to him, the only one who can sustain our lives. But ordinary kippur will not work because it would involve destruction of the entire human race. So he has devised another kind of kippur strategy, which he illustrated in a limited way through the ancient Israelite sanctuary and its services. Such kippur was not universal for all peoples, but it included an objective component that was done for the Israelites, and it involved the legal element of ransom through substitution. Leviticus 17:11 most clearly reveals this kind of kippur. The following subsections describe the objective framework of the Israelite ritual system, identify terminology of ransom in Exodus 30 as background to Leviticus 17:11, investigate evidence for objective ransom through substitution by animal life in Leviticus 17:11, demonstrate that this principle operated in all kinds of Israelite blood sacrifices, explore the nature of the human death from which ransom was obtained, observe that animal life was inadequate to substitute for human life, point out the substitutionary but inadequate role of the Israelite priesthood, and show how Christ meets the need for an adequate victim priest in the book of Hebrews. Those are just my subtopics there. Okay, first, the objective framework. The Israelite ritual worship system was objective in the sense that many aspects were done for the people apart from their individual volition and participation. First, God initiated the entire system, giving plans for development of the sanctuary infrastructure, instructions for ritual performance, and rules for protecting the boundaries of the sacred domain. Second, God appointed priests, with Levites assisting them, to serve him and maintain the sanctuary on behalf of the people, officiate their sacrifices, and bear their culpabilities. Third, God commanded public sacrifices on behalf of the entire community, such as the regular daily morning and evening burnt offerings, and additional sacrifices on Sabbaths, new moons, and festival occasions. Second, ransom. In Exodus 30, the Lord required each Israelite to give him half a shekel of silver when a military census was taken. The half shekel served as a ransom, Hebrew kofar, for the life that is the nephesh of each one who paid it. Quote, that there would be no plague among them when you number them. There were life and death consequences if the high body counts of divine plagues on Israel recorded elsewhere are any indication. Notice that the Hebrew word for ransom is the noun kofar from the same root as kipar. Then Exodus 30 twice states the life-saving function of the half-shekel ransom, quote, to ransom your lives, using the Hebrew expression kipar al-nefesh, verses 15 and 16. By itself, the combination kipar plus the preposition al means make expiation on behalf of someone. That is, remove an impediment to the divine relationship, prerequisite to forgiveness. However, when the word nefesh, life, follows kipar al, as the object of the preposition al and the indirect object of the verb kipar, there is an added nuance, because expiation on behalf of the human life indicates removal of an impediment to the divine-human relationship that threatens the life. Without this removal, the human life would die. The translation, ransom life, is an attempt to capture the meaning of this expression, kipar al nefesh. We're not talking about kind of ransom that a kidnapper does, okay? This is ransom in the sense of something that's given to protect a person from harm. A ransom is a payment that removes an obstacle to someone's freedom. If it is ransom for life, the deliverance is from death. William Gilders, in his blood ritual in the Hebrew Bible, points out that ransom for life is not necessarily substitutionary. Silver served as ransom to free a person from harm, but it did not take the place of the person to suffer that harm. Okay? So ransom, by definition, is not necessarily including the substitutionary element. That's an important point. Now we're going to go on and talk about substitution. In Leviticus 17:11, God specifies a special kind of kipar al-nefesh, this time not with silver, that he invented to ransom the lives of his chosen people through animal sacrifices. In its context, this verse provides the rationale for the permanent prohibition against eating the meat of any animal from which the blood is not drained out at the time of slaughter. Leviticus 17:11 explains, "For the life, that is the nefesh, of a creature is in the blood, and I have assigned it to you on the altar to ransom, kipar al, your lives, plural of nefesh, for the blood ransoms, kipar, by means of the life, nefesh." Notice that the words "by means of" here interpret the debated preposition bet in an instrumental sense. In my seminar with Jacob Milgram at UC Berkeley, we spent 2.5 hours discussing that Hebrew letter, and it didn't resolve it. That was in-depth study. There are two reasons why it is forbidden to eat meat with the blood still in it. First, the blood contains the life, that is, in the sense that blood sustains life. Second, God has a sign, that is verb natan, literally given, the lifeblood of sacrificial animals, the function of ransoming the lives of the humans on whose behalf they are offered by having the blood applied to his altar of the sanctuary. This function is a gift of God to his people. And I didn't make that up. William Gilders states that, and he's right. It's a gift of God to make that function. The two reasons are not separate. Logically, the second depends on the first. It is because the life is in the blood that God has provided it as the means of ransoming human life. Therefore, the life of the sacrificial victim is what ransoms the life of the human offerer. Lest there is any doubt, the last part of the verse adds, "For the blood ransoms by means of the life." That is, it is not simply the blood that ransoms. Rather, it is the life in the blood that is the means of ransom. The transaction is nephesh for nephesh, life for life. Here the blood ransom for life, yiper al nephesh, is not merely a token that delivers from harm, like the half shekel of silver in Exodus 30, nor is it merely a compensatory payment of damages that serves as an instrument of reconciliation and prevents reprisal, as when an individual gives something he owns to another person who he's wronged, Exodus 21, Genesis 32, and so on. Rather, there is a token substitution of one life for another, without which the human party would die. That which ransoms the human nephesh is a functionally equivalent animal nephesh that suffers death in place of the human. This is ransom through substitution, as William Gilders has recognized in his book, Blood Ritual in the Hebrew Bible. The section I've just summarized on substitutionary ransom in all kinds of blood sacrifices, I'm not going to read that section. I'm going to summarize it briefly to save time. Leviticus 17:11 is the only biblical verse that explicitly explains the function of sacrificial blood. Some scholars have argued that this substitutionary ransom for life does not operate in all kinds of sacrifices. Now, the first argument is that of my teacher, Jacob Milgram, who said it only applies to the well-being offering. But I have evidence that, in fact, it goes beyond that, and it's on here. A little bit of it is on your handout. Another interesting argument, in some ways more interesting, is a source-critical argument by William Gilders, who says, this passage in Leviticus 17:11 is H, and according to recent theory of source criticism from Israel Knoll and Jacob Milgram and so on, H, the holiness code, is historically following P, the priestly source. Okay? So therefore, this late explanation of the sacrifices would not have been known by the earlier priestly writers. Therefore, you can't sort of eisegete this later H interpretation and explain the P sacrifices by that. You see the idea? Okay. But I've answered that on the handout by referring to another passage, Numbers 15:28, which scholars like Canal say is also H. But here, this is forming a terminological bridge to the so-called P passages, the earlier part of Leviticus, and in fact it's demonstrating that really the idea of Kiper al-Nefesh is already there back in those earlier sacrificial prescriptions, because the offerer is referred to as a Nefesh, and then it refers to he gets Kiper al. So you've got Kiper al-Nefesh in those passages already. And so I was using a source critical argument against that source critical argument, you could say. And the bottom line comes out to be that in fact Leviticus 17:11 does apply to all of the various sacrifices. And it would anyway, if we accept biblical inspiration, that is an inspired commentary on the sacrifices. And even if that explanation comes later, it doesn't mean that it's not right, just as when Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man. Now, Genesis doesn't say that, but the implication is already there. Okay, I think you get the point, so I'm going to move on. The next section, the death from which life is ransomed. Some scholars raise a further problem regarding Leviticus 17:11. An Israelite could not gain amnesty from a capital offense by offering an animal sacrifice. So how could the Israelite sacrifices be regarded as ransoming life when they did not really ransom life? You see the problem? Ransom for life implies that the offerer should die unless the animal dies instead. However, the offerer was not guilty of death, or at least not according to the system of specific humanly and divinely administered judicial penalties stated in the Pentateuchal laws. However, full adherence to God's covenant is a life and death matter. The Israelites acknowledged that when they heard the Book of the Covenant and pledged all that the Lord had spoken, we will do and we will be obedient, and then allowed Moses to toss the blood of the covenant sacrifices on them. They didn't duck or run away, right? So committing a sin required ransom for life through the blood of a sacrifice at God's covenant headquarters, where he resided and where the record of his covenant stipulations was kept. All human beings are faulty, subject to the sinful state of depravity and mortality, even when they have no present need of forgiveness for particular acts of sin. This concept was reinforced by sacrifices that expiated for, kiper al, Israelites to purify them from physical ritual impurities. These were not sinful actions that required forgiveness. Rather, they emphasized the birth-to-death cycle of mortality that results from sin. Therefore, even approaching the Holy Deity through well-being offerings for happy motivations of thanksgiving, fulfillment of vows, or voluntary expressions of devotion involves application of sacrificial blood to the altar as ransom for the lives of the offerers. You see the point? Okay? In other words, there's a higher, more sensitive standard of life and death than is present in the judicial system. Any sin involves a violation which results in the penalty of death, in the ultimate covenant scheme of things. Ellen White recognized this principle about sacrifices. I'll just remind you, this is in First Selected Messages. There, she says, the religious services, the prayers, the praise, the penitent confession of sin ascends from true believers as incense to the heavenly sanctuary. But passing through the corrupt channels of humanity, they are so defiled that unless purified by blood, they can never be of value with God. Okay, and then I think you know the rest of the statement. It's really very beautiful. We need the intercessor, Christ, the merit of his sacrifice, to purify even our praise to God. It's not just about when we commit sins. Okay, the next section. Animal life is inadequate to ransom human life. How can the life of an animal, represented by its lifeblood, ransom the life of a human being? Israelites did not regard the life of an animal as equivalent to that of a human, and neither did divine law. For example, Leviticus 24:21 stipulates, one who kills an animal shall make restitution for it, but one who kills a human being shall be put to death. So it is actually impossible for animal blood to take away sins by ransoming human life, as Hebrews 10 verse 4 recognizes. Psalm 49:7-9 gives a logical step further. Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life, for the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. When it comes to eternal life, ransom for a person cannot be obtained at the cost of a human being, let alone property such as an animal, or even many herds of animals, according to Micah 6, verse 7. The closest the Israelite ritual system comes to human sacrifice is the burning of a Nazarite shaved hair in the fire under the well-being offering, Numbers 6, verse 18. But the hair offering accompanies a group of animal sacrifices, it does not replace them. Although Leviticus 17:11 speaks of animal sacrifice in language referring to ransom for human life, and although such a sacrifice costs the offerer something, his or her animal, the ransom of incomparable value occurs only because God has assigned that function to animal blood applied to his altar. It really is a gift. This is a kind of ransom through a substitute, but not a substitute of equivalent worth. Rather, it's only token ransom. It's a token substitute. In fact, it is God, the injured party, who pays the token ransom. This does not satisfy the claims of justice because it's radically tilted in the direction of mercy. Consequently, God bears an accumulating burden of judicial responsibility for forgiving sinners, which a judge is not supposed to do. That's not part of the job description of a judge. In Deuteronomy 25:1, and then in 1 Kings 8:32, referring to God in this case, a judge is supposed to condemn the guilty and vindicate the innocent, not forgive the guilty. So when God forgives guilty people like you and me, there's this burden of the tilt towards mercy, this judicial responsibility accumulates until the Day of Atonement, Israel's judgment day, when it's removed from God as represented by purgation of his sanctuary headquarters. Now let's talk about priestly substitution. Thus far we have discussed substitution by an animal victim. Leviticus 10:17 attests another kind of substitution, in this case by priests. Here Moses asks the newly consecrated priest about the inaugural purification offering on behalf of the community. Here is what he says. Why didn't you eat the purification offering in the holy area? Except, you know, he's really mad. Why didn't you eat the purification offering in the holy area? For it's most holy, and it was assigned to you for bearing, that is, Nasah, the culpability of the community by making expiation on their behalf before the Lord. That's a little bit better, huh? For when a person sins, he bears, nasah, his own culpability, hatzolo, usually translated iniquity. But that culpability or condemnation is removed from the person if God forgives his sin, verse 6 of Leviticus 5, and then God bears it. Compare Leviticus, or rather Exodus 34, verse 7, where it says, this is speaking of God's character. The Lord is merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. You remember that? That's verse 6. Verse 7 says, Nose avon bepesha v'chata'ah, bearing iniquity and transgression and sin. None of the English translations say that. They all say forgiving. But the Hebrew word is nose, the same word, and it's bearing. Okay? When God forgives sin, he bears it. Interesting. As God's representatives, Israel's priests represented his role by bearing the culpability, same expression, nasa'avon, of the people on whose behalf they officiated sacrifices at the outer altar, the meat of which they ate. Outside Leviticus, there are other passages in which the high priests or all the priests bear culpability, same term, nasa'avon, that the people of their community would otherwise bear. In these instances, condemnation is transferred from lay Israelites to their priestly representatives, who also represent God's roles for them, so that the lay people are free from punishment. Another way to say it is that the priests substitute for their people. However, if the priests properly do their jobs, they do not actually suffer punishment as a result. So again, as with ransom through animals, the ritual system short-circuits the full claims of justice. The Levitical system is inadequate. I hate to say it. It's my specialty, Leviticus, but it's inadequate. In Numbers 35:28, there's just a hint as to what full justice would look like. An Israelite who has committed accidental homicide must remain in a city of refuge until the death of the high priest, at which time he may return home. So in this case, the death of the high priest has a kind of a ransoming function, which is confirmed by verse 32, and you shall accept no ransom, kofar, same word that we saw in Exodus 30, for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. This verse envisages, but prohibits, the possibility that a ransom could be paid to free the involuntary manslayer from confinement to the city of refuge. Nevertheless, the death of the high priest accomplishes the objective of such a ransom. This is not human sacrifice. The high priest dies a natural death. But there's a kind of substitution here. The life of the high priest, rather than the life of the manslayer, is for the life of the slain person. Now, this is background for the book of Hebrews. So let's look at what truly adequate substitution looks like in the book of Hebrews. This may provide a little background to Felix's paper, I think. And hopefully we agree. We'll find out. We agree on most things, don't we, Felix? We'll see. In Leviticus and related biblical literature, we have found legal substitutions by animal victims and priests. These substitutions provided merciful freedom from condemnation, but they were massively inadequate when it came to fulfilling the needs of justice. There was a glaring need for a more valuable kind of victim and for a kind of priest who actually suffered the results of the culpabilities that he would bear on behalf of others. Passages such as Psalm 40 and 110, Isaiah 53 and Daniel 9 point to a messianic victim and priest, but it is in the New Testament book of Hebrews that we find full exposition of the greater victimhood and priesthood of the divine Christ. Most crucial for our discussion is the dynamic connection in Hebrews between Christ's roles as priest and victim. But when Christ appeared as a high priest, this is Hebrews 9, 11 to 12, but when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of his creation, of this creation, entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. That's ESV translation. Thus Christ is qualified for his unique priesthood on our behalf, because he has also served as our sacrificial victim. You can't separate his priesthood from his role as the victim. They go together. As the Aaronic priests bore culpabilities of their people, Leviticus 10:17, Christ has borne our culpability. But unlike those Israelite priests, Christ has died as a result of that culpability of ours that he has carried. as Hebrews 9:28 expresses it. So Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many. Christ meets the needs for a victim of adequate value and for a priest who dies for the sins of the people that he bears. The fact that he has borne our sins as our priest and then died for those sins as our victim proves beyond all question that he is our substitute, whose ransom lavishly fulfills God's need for justice, which is necessary to maintain his character of uncompromising love. It's not an animal for our lives. It's God's own Son, a divine being, his life, which is so superior to ours, in place of ours. Okay, the second main subsection of this presentation, or overall section, is experiential transformation. Yes, the legal objective aspect is absolutely necessary for us to be saved. But we cannot be saved without appropriating it. The subjective aspect of accepting this objective, yes, is crucial. So that's what we're going to talk about now. Background. The narrative framework work of Leviticus is set in the context of the Israelites' epic journey from slavery in Egypt to a life of freedom in the land that the Lord had promised them. God initiated and miraculously facilitated this journey in order to transform their experience. Okay, so we already have experiential transformation, right? Especially in relation to himself as their covenant Lord. At Mount Sinai, he proclaimed to them through Moses, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a priest, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation." To accept their calling as a holy nation, the Israelites were to cooperate with God by living holy lives, defined as adherence to his good laws, in harmony with his holy character. He established an earthly residence in their midst in order to be as close to his faulty people as possible without destroying them by revealing his unveiled glory. There, through officiation by priests whom he authorized, they were to interact with him through rituals that maintained his awesome presence with regular service, honored him on special occasions, expressed thanks and devotion, and sought reconciliation with him when they violated his laws. His beneficent presence, guiding and protecting them, was at the center of their camp and at the center of their lives. The Israelites' experience was radically changed from the bad old days when Pharaoh's oppressive, exploitive power dominated their lives. The following subsections will look at evidence for experiential transformation in the context of participation by offerers in sacrifices for sin, participation on other occasions, and a call to enjoy the effects of Christ's sacrifice in the book of Hebrews. First, participation by offerers in sacrifices for sins. When Israelites made mistakes, they were to express their penitence and ongoing loyalty through accepting God's provisions for putting things right by offering sacrifices. It was not enough to believe in the objective efficacy of the morning and evening burnt offerings and the special expiatory sacrifices that the priests performed for the whole community on festival occasions, Numbers 28 and 29. An individual, whether man or woman, okay, and then I'm going to repeat that, an individual, whether man or woman, was to bring his or her own animal, lean one hand on its head, slit its throat, and cut up the animal as necessary. The priests were to perform all mediatorial actions connected with the most holy altar, including applying blood to it and burning the Lord's flesh portions, but the offerers participated in the sacrifice. Priests and offerers worked together, with the priests providing the objective activities that the offerers could not do for themselves, and the offerers subjectively entering into the experience. You cannot separate the objective from the subjective. They are just intertwined. You read Leviticus 1. Objective and subjective elements were both necessary and inseparable. Not until the sacrificial process was complete, including application of blood and flesh to the altar through priestly mediation, could it be said that kippur was accomplished. Sacrifice includes not death of the victim, which was a relatively minor part of it, okay? But it also included priestly mediation. See, we have erroneously tended to talk about Christ's sacrifice, followed by his mediation, followed by the final atonement, and that is wrong, because Christ's sacrifice includes his mediation. You do not have kippur accomplished without mediation. It's just as important for our salvation as his death on the cross. Most Christians don't realize that, but this is biblical. Okay, participation by offerers did not mean that they earned their own salvation, which was beyond their capability and was God's gift that was made available to them through the objective infrastructure and provisions of the sanctuary system. Rather, the offerer's part was to accept and cooperate with the gift, expressing faith in the divinely appointed ransom that pointed beyond a token animal to a much greater sacrifice. The trajectory of events in Leviticus 5 reveals the experience of a given Israelite who sins and consequently bears his own culpability in verse 1, which would inexorably lead to punishment. My friend Brooke Schwartz writes about this term, this avon is like a great burden that's on the back of the sinner. The sinner bears, like in Pilgrim's Progress, remember? You remember that great burden? And then finally it rolls off. Now my friend is an Orthodox Jew, so he doesn't talk about rolling off of the tomb of Christ the way Bunyan did, but the point of the burden is still there. It inexorably leads to punishment unless something happens. But when the person confesses his sin, verse 5 of Leviticus 5, and offers a purification offering, so-called sin offering, the priest expiates for, kiperal, the individual from, preposition mean, his sin, verse 6. The fact that the sin is removed from the sinner means that he or she is to be treated as though the sin had not occurred, which means that the consequential culpability is gone, as confirmed by the fact that God forgets. And I'm thinking of what Dick Davidson read to us last night, a quotation from Ellen White, that we are as though we had never sinned. See? And this is what this is implying. The sin is gone in this case. Not stated is the person's expected response, which should be relief, gratitude, and commitment to avoid repeating the sin in the future. Israelites were accountable for taking the initiative to offer sacrifices for sin when they realized on their own that they had sinned or when someone else made it known to them. Offering any kind of sacrifice for sin would express penitence. Additional oral confession contributed to the expression of penitence in some cases in which sin had been concealed or had resulted from forgetfulness. Another expression of penitence was payment of reparation in cases involving misuse of property. This is in Leviticus 5. An Israelite who had inadvertently misused something holy was required to make reparation to God, Leviticus 5:16, and an individual who used a false oath to defraud another person was to make reparation to the wrong party before offering a reparation offering in Leviticus 6, verse 5. So the system of expiatory sacrifices and associated penalties required the active involvement of sinners to acknowledge their accountability and to put things right in order to heal relationships. Because that's what it's all about. The whole system is all about relationships. And the whole symbolic system, defilements, everything, the legal aspects, it's all about relationships. So they could, in this way, symbolically heal relationships that they had negatively affected. Through this system, God was teaching them how to live in harmony with his values. Participation on other occasions. God not only taught the Israelites how to deal with their active sin, he also taught them about their physical state of mortal sinfulness by contrast to his immortal holiness. He did this through a system that protected the sphere of holiness centered at his sanctuary residence from contamination by physical ritual impurities. Israelites who incurred minor impurities were to gain purification from them by bathing, washing their clothes, and waiting until evening. When the causes of serious impurities had stopped, in some cases when they were healed from unhealthy conditions, those affected were to offer purification offerings quantitatively supplemented by burnt offerings. So purification offerings, in which offerers participated, remedied not only moral faults, they also contributed to purification from physical impurities. This implies that the purification offering was concerned with comprehensive healing from moral faultiness and physical mortality. Now you see, we often miss that. We think that the sanctuary and the sin offering is, this is what we're talking about, so-called sin offering, purification offering. We talk about it in exclusively legal terms, don't we, as Adventists? But it's not. It's about healing as well. And both go together. You can't separate them. And I think we need to emphasize the healing, especially at Loma Linda. Right? Okay, on the Day of Atonement, residual effects of physical impurities and moral faults that had accumulated at the sanctuary were purged from it, resulting in the moral purification of the people. This purification was objectively provided for all Israel, but to receive the benefit, each individual was required to participate in the experience by practicing self-denial, which could include fasting and other practices associated with intense petition to God at special times of need. God arranged for plenty of external factors, including participation in powerfully evocative activity, including the annual festival, to influence the internal attitude of the Israelites if they would only allow themselves to be transformed. The whole system was a huge, massive invitation, right? And one of the sweetest is in number 6, where any Israelite, male or female, says man or woman, can be a Nazirite. The most holy status that a lay Israelite could experience. And some of the aspects of their lifestyle coincided with those of a high priest. I mean, it was that holy. And anyone could, for a temporary time, enter into that experience. God, set up this opportunity. Come and be special with me. It's just beautiful. Everyone was deeply impressed when divine fire consumed the inaugural sacrifices. But two brief narratives in Leviticus report fatal failures by two newly consecrated priests and a brawling, blaspheming half-Israelite. The book of Numbers recounts the tragic loss of an entire generation due to faithlessness. God's plan for experiential transformation supplied an overwhelmingly persuasive invitation, but not coercion that overrided free choice. And I'm just amazed by the contrast between Genesis 4 verse 7, where God says to Cain, if you don't do well, sin is crouching at the door. What? Does it knock? Oh no. It crouches like a pussycat. We used to have a cat that just busted in the door whenever it could. But this is like a saber-toothed tiger, and its desire is for you. Right? And it's a predator. Contrast that with Revelation 3 verse 20. Jesus, who created us, respected our free choice so much that he stands at the door and knocks. And if and only if we open the door and let him in, will he come in. What a contrast between God's respect for free choice and sin and Satan, which doesn't. Okay, the final section here is experiential transformation in Hebrews. The book of Hebrews reveals transforming effect on those who accept Christ's objective sacrifice. In Hebrews 9, the blood of Christ will purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God. In other words, the objective fact of Christ's sacrifice then has this subjective effect. Similarly, Hebrews 10:14 says, for by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. Same kind of connection, right? Then Hebrews 10 applies to those who accept Christ's sacrifice, the Jeremiah 31 promise of a new covenant in which God would put his laws on the hearts and minds of his people and remember their sins no more. Following in Hebrews 10 is a magnificent invitation which expands on concepts expressed earlier in the book. Hebrews 10:19-25 urges fellow believers, therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus. Okay, so he's saying the foundation, the basis of everything, is that substitutionary atonement, that accomplished objective fact. Okay? As a result, therefore, by the new and living way that he has already opened for us through the curtain, that is through his flesh. And since we have a great priest over the house of God. Okay, the infrastructure is all set up, right? Let us, therefore, draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. This is metaphorical, right? Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. Here, experiential transformation is based on the objective, accomplished fact of the substitutionary sacrifice of Jesus. Without Christ's sacrifice, there would be no transformation. It is also true that unless a person accepts that sacrifice and experiences transformation, the sacrifice does not achieve its goal for that individual. This is why the affirmation in 2 Corinthians 5:19 that in Christ God was reconciling the world to himself, so there was that objective accomplished fact to the whole world, that is, this world that got hijacked, is going to be restored to the fellowship of planets belonging to God. Right? That verse is followed by verse 20. We implore you, on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. In other words, there's an amnesty for all of planet Earth, which is already accomplished. Now you individually lay down your arms, lay down your weapons, and stop fighting. See how that works? I mean, that's what we did in Iraq, isn't it, United States? We go in there, we conquer the whole place, it's ours, and now we say to the individual fighters, okay, we're going to give you amnesty. You've already got the amnesty. All you've got to do is cooperate with it and accept it. Conclusion. In Leviticus, animal sacrifices serve as token substitutes to ransom the lives of Israelites from objective legal culpability. Aaronic priests also bear culpability of substitutes for their people, but they do not actually suffer the consequences. The book of Hebrews identifies Christ as the priest who bears human sins and actually suffers the consequences of those sins as the victim of adequate, in fact I would say, lavishly superior value. This combination of roles as victim priest proves that Christ's atonement is substitutionary. The scope of his atonement is not limited to Israelites, but is available to all inhabitants of planet Earth. Even if they have committed sins that were inexpiable through the Israelite sacrificial system, if they will only accept his accomplished provision for their salvation. Acts 13:39 is very important. This is Paul preaching. He says, through the sacrifice of Christ, you can receive forgiveness for all the sins for which you couldn't receive forgiveness under the law of Moses. You see, so it has more powerful power for the individual, but also its universal scope. The Israelites were faulty, but they were called to emulate their covenant Lord, who was comprehensively changing their experience by living holy lives in harmony with his principles. They were to receive remedies for their moral failures and serious manifestations of physical mortality by offering sacrifices in which they participated. Thus, having richly provided everything they needed, God required their cooperation as an expression of their choice to receive his gifts of deliverance and transformation. All they're doing is receiving the gift. That's all. That's all we ever do. Right? The gift is already there. It's an accomplished fact. In harmony with Leviticus, the book of Hebrews invites people to enter a transformed experience by accepting the objective reality of Christ's ministry on their behalf.